Okay, see what we got. What are the consequences of breaking a precept? Hedging the bets here. I think one of the things is recognizing that, from the Buddha's perspective, one of the purposes, what we translate as a precept, is a in the scriptural language. Its literal translation is the word is sikha padam. So it's actually the same word that in the mindfulness of breathing, they're saying train, like I train thus. A verb is sikati. And in this, so sikha is the same, it's the same word, same verb. Sikapadam pada is foot, literally foot, so it means foundation or basis. So it's the basis of training, basis of study, basis of learning, basis of education. So that so a precept is something that we're taking a certain standard of conduct in order to train ourselves and to learn. Learn what are the consequences of breaking a precept, or what are the consequences of keeping a precept, so that the a lot of the say action results of action from the Buddha's perspective come from the nature and the strength of the volition behind it, or the intention behind it, so that a so there's all sorts of different ways that one can say break a precept, but you've got to go back and say, well, what was the intention behind that? What was the volition of the mind? So, like to say to break a precept out of just muddled mindfulness, or breaking a precept out of this sort of revenge, or you know, there's a whole different result. So that the it's like Ajahn Chah. One of the ways that he would always instruct us in terms of how we hold precepts and train with precepts is to, in terms of their function, the function was to give one the opportunity to understand intention and volition. That's its function, so that they're not there to sort of whip you into shape. They're there as a protection, as well as a basis of training. So the consequences of breaking a precept is oftentimes the first person that usually experiences the results of breaking a precept is ourselves. Oftentimes we don't feel good about it, especially if we've made a commitment to try to hold to a standard of integrity, and then we let ourselves down with that. Also, another aspect of precepts is the one of the, or two of the principles that underlie wholesome conduct and say, and maintaining an integrity of conduct is in the scriptural language hiri and otapa, and they're what the Buddha calls the protectors of the world. So they're hiri, and it's impossible to translate it beautifully into English because the doesn't quite translate because of much of the associations that we have. So that hiri is like a the most common translation is moral shame. It's got a lot of baggage with it, but what it's pointing to is a, again, because it's hard to find an English term, it's pointing to an internal quality of, say, embarrassment or say compunction or concern of transgressing a precept, because it oversteps the boundaries of one's own inner values, so that it's something we ourselves don't feel good about, and because it doesn't. And then otapa is a usually translated as fear of wrongdoing, but it's a recognition of the that there are consequences, there are results, so that the that quality of otapa shrinks back from unskillful action because one recognizes that it has that potential of harming others. And the root of both of those qualities is, I say, the inner quality that forms hiri and otapa is respect. So that hiri is grounded in a respect for oneself, so one doesn't want to do something that is, kind of goes against one's values. And otapa is respect for others, because one doesn't want to harm or create suffering for others. So that they're rooted in this quality of respect. So it's precepts, there's a dynamic in there that is I think quite nuanced and to me very, very wholesome. Some meditators associate quote-unquote peak experiences with spiritual progress. What are the benefits and drawbacks of this approach? One is the in terms of a drawback is we're looking for peak experiences and oftentimes not paying attention to the actual work that we need to do. It's sort of where the motivation is to get something out of our meditation or our practice, and we're constantly measuring ourselves and our experience according to some idea of what a peak experience is or should be or could be. And that's To me, that's very problematic. The benefit could be that one recognizes that there is something beyond our ho-hum, humdrum, run-of-the-mill consciousness. I mean, there is something beyond that that is realizable. Of the four elements, please explain wind element. So that the four elements, earth, fire, water, wind. The manifestation of what is translated as the wind element is the it's the element of extension. So that if I extend my arm out, it would in terms of how the Buddha is. And in the time of the Buddha, how they would explain that it's that element of extension and movement, so the movement of air is an obvious one, but it's also the so it's not a say when we speak of the wind element, it's not like it manifests a wind blowing around here and there, but it's a bit more primal in terms of how these are manifested. So that what they call the earth element is the element of solidity, something that's solid, has weight, takes up space. Of course, the fire element is the element of heat or lack of heat. Water element is the element of fluidity, but also. Cohesion. It's what binds things, mixes things, binds. So the element of cohesion. So in the Buddhist perspective of say of nature, those are these how these elements manifest themselves. Okay, so luminous is the mind. Is the luminous mind conditioned or unconditioned? If unconditioned, then it's nirvana. If conditioned, impermanent, then nirvana is beyond the mind. Yet it can be known by the mind, the luminous mind. Yeah, I mean, the luminous mind in this sense is somebody really went to town on this. it's stimulating to reflect on that. Luminous mind in that context, in that sutta, and what the Buddha is pointing to is conditioned. It's not pointing to an unconditioned. Not pointing to Nibbana, so that they and in terms of Nibbana is beyond, because the mind is conditioned, and Nibbana is beyond conditions. Nibbana is the unconditioned. It can be experienced, it can be experienced. It can be known. And then, and said, And then it's just as a misheard, when I'm saying the defilements are adventitious, not advantageous. they're adventitious, adventitious, meaning coming and going. Yeah, and not so advantageous. do any of you who reside at the monastery vote in local or national elections? Wondering also if you get involved in public discussions on local policies as they pertain to or potentially could affect the monastery. Now, we don't vote. That's part of, it's very strong in Thai culture that the monastics are not involved in the political process at all. They're not really, which is, say, quite different from, say, Sri Lanka, where you've got monks running for elections in parliament. And it's, I can't get my mind around it. Why? Why would you do that to yourself? but we don't engage in that level of political participation. Public discussion on local policies. Somebody trying to purchase land. Actually, they did purchase it. They purchased the land about 300 acres or something in the valley, and that was in order to basically to yeah, it was a timber harvest for okay, so that we engaged with the local people who worked with the forestry department, and the forestry department was great because they just have to follow a process, and they were actually really praised us as local people getting involved, so that the timber harvest was turned down, and then he ended up selling the land, and that's Huck's land now. Got involved in that. I don't know if we've got involved with much else. I can't think of anything. Persistent physical pain. Not chronic, just from sitting. How do I skillfully work with it? Right now, the meditations feel swamped with it. And sometimes with physical pain, especially from sitting, pay attention to ways that like doing more walking meditation. Sometimes we have the assumption that meditation equals sitting, and. But walking meditation is just as valid a meditation as anything, or standing. To alleviate and to make the body feel a bit more comfortable, doing exercises through the day so that, that there's a loosening it up. Do the Qigong at 4:45. So that it's just working physically with that. It's a way to work with it physically. In terms of with the meditation, with the breath, like taking the physical body as an object and bathing the physical body and sensations of discomfort in the breath, relaxing, soothing, making the body feel comfortable with the breath, that softening, relaxing, releasing. That's a helpful way of alleviating pain. But it's also, because sometimes that provides relief, but then, the body's still uncomfortable. So you have to pay attention to, what does the body need so that, because sometimes you just have to give it more time with doing walking meditation so that it eases the physical discomfort. Could you talk about how to manage doubt when it arises? I think one of the things about doubt is, of course, it's looking for an answer about the things that it doubts about. And then whatever answer you come up with, it's going to doubt it. So, I mean, it's a catch-22, which is we tie ourselves in knots with doubt. And I really find that bringing attention back into the body is really helpful. Finding ways to engage attention and mindfulness with the body so that there's a continuity of mindfulness built up. Because it's the continuity of mindfulness and clarity that we build up that's going to alleviate the doubt, as opposed to any particular clever answer for our doubts. Because even if you think your way through to the right answer, but there's still the mind's just still doubting, we'll be uncertain about that. So that coming back to the body, coming back to the a body-based awareness, so that there can be some clarity built up. That's where doubt starts to get undermined. Do monks on retreat feel as much pain as we do? I don't know about any of the other monks, but I do. That's a pretty constant companion for me. Pain is a pretty regular feature of my experience. Just learn to work with it and But as in the previous question, or is that doing things physically that help to alleviate it, or bathing the body in the I've got tons of old injuries and a fractured pelvis from 25 years ago has come back to haunt me a couple of years ago, and monks feel pain too. Is pain sankharas? Pain is vedana. Pain is feeling. It's a feeling. It's a primal. The aversion to the pain is a sankhara. The plotting of how to get out of the pain is a sankhara. The woe is me is a sankhara. So sankharas are mental formations. And then it says, can you repeat the aspect of sankharas other than mental volitional energy? Sankhara, as I said, there's a few different ways that it's used in the scriptural language, but sankhara, its main meaning is that of a compounded nature, so that anything of a physical or mental, internal, external, whatever, is a sankhara. And then, in the sense that it's of a compounded nature. Nibbana is the only thing that is not a sankhara. But then, sankhara in terms of a mental, let's say mental formation, so as we do the chanting in the morning with the five khandhas, sankhara, the distinguishing characteristic of a sankhara in the khandhas is volition or intention, so that all types of thinking, emotion, it's all sankhara. Is it better to stick to one mode of breath meditation or visualization or mantra, etc., for a while during the course of a 30 to 45 minute sit, rather than jumping around to various modes? In an ideal world, yes. Sometimes our mind is less than ideal, so that sometimes you have to adjust it realize that, okay, I'm determined to sit for this time, and this just isn't grabbing me. It isn't, and so that you have to experiment a bit. If you've got the the patience and determination to stick with it, it's really good. But also, you have to recognize that sometimes we just stick with something because we're used to it or we think we should. And also recognize that you've got options. It's all, whether one shifts from the breath and picks up a mantra or picks up a visualization, it's not unwholesome. It's not like you're doing a bad thing. But, sometimes we set up an expectation for ourselves, and then we aren't able to do that. One does have to investigate, because sometimes we do jump around just because we're restless and impatient, and we're looking for a quick fix, and that's not a wholesome, or that's not a skillful motivation. So that you have to pay attention to what the own feeling is, the own circumstance is, and then adjust accordingly. That tendency to, if we have that tendency to just be impatient and restless, then it's helpful to stick with it, because the we don't develop much depth in the practice, or the depth of experience doesn't manifest. So you have to pay attention to what the mind is doing and what the circumstance is. Okay. My question is on the order of the list of the five khandhas. If it is intended to be linear, why is sense consciousness the final one? Seems to me that vijnana arises quickly, if not before feeling, then at least prior to perception. Am I just not watching closely enough? Does vijnana not arise until after sankhara? It's not intended to be linear. There's a very explicit statement that the Buddha gives around these khandhas, these five khandhas, and that they are conjoined. They are not disjoined. So they're not separate. You have to use separate words just because to give it a bit more shape, to get a handle on it so that you can investigate it. But they're not actual entities that are absolutely separate from each other. They are conjoined. They're not disjoined. So that they're... So it's not meant to be a linear process. It's just describing some of the constituents of our mental world, and in other lists, the Buddha will sometimes add other aspects, say like attention, contact. As well, and so but these are they're primal aspects of function, so that they're sort of kind of flags, these experiences flags, so that we can recognize them a bit more clearly. Sometimes the Buddha simplifies it and just says, say like nama and rupa, so body and mind. Mentality, materiality. That gets a bit vague. The most common that the Buddha uses is the five khandhas. What is the difference between a fetter and a hindrance? A hindrance, these are classifications of, say, defilements or mental states that are they're problematic, leading to suffering. They have different they're used in different ways. So that, say, like the a hindrance in the scriptural language is nivarana, and these are the hindrances that that obstruct awareness and hamper discernment, clear discernment, wisdom. So let's say, whereas a fetter is sangyojana in the Pali, and a fetter is something a bit more primal or deeply rooted, that is like the fetter. There are 10 fetters, 10 sangyojana, and the first three are relinquished by a stream enterer. So that's it's like a hindrance. If you have to deal with the hindrances so that the mind can become peaceful and clear and have a settled quality to it. And even when the mind is settled, the hindrances are in abeyance, the fetters are still quite happy. Thank you. fetter is, say, more deeply kind of rooted, and say, then they're shed by the, say, insight, and so that the insight and of a stream enterer, one's able to relinquish the fetter of identity view, sakkaya ditti, of skeptical doubt, vicikicca, and attachment to practice and precept, sila patta paramasa, so that that's a it's not that one doesn't keep precepts anymore, so don't have to bother with the practice. But what it means is that one doesn't assume that if I just did this and got it right, then I'd be pure. I could get purity out of following a particular ritual or precept or a particular practice, particular way of doing things, and that would purify me. Those are the fetters that are relinquished by a stream enterer. Then the next fetters are sense desire, ill will, and those are attenuated by the once returner, and then they are completely relinquished by the non-returner, and then the arahant is able to release the last five fetters, which one of them, as Ajñānikō mentioned, is that restlessness and the final one is sort of ignorance, avijja. So it's not knowing the true nature of things.
Just one phrase I heard, simple phrase for fetters, is it's that which binds us to samsara.
Oh, okay, that's a good. Fetter is that which binds us to samsara, okay? Round of rebirth. Okay, one of the books I've read suggests to practice the last moment of life every night. The book suggests to imagine that, what if this, your current breath, is your last breath? What would it be? What would you suggest for practicing Maranamasati, which is mindfulness of or recollection of death? Recollection of death is really important, powerful, motivating, and to bring to mind using the imagination. What if this was my last breath? Just especially if we're ending the day like that. Yeah, what if I don't, you know, what if this is my last night? What if this is my last day? Of course, you know, in reality, it's the each moment is like that. But to make it kind of overt and conscious, to remind ourselves, it's very, very, very helpful. So that contemplation of death is not a morbid, depressing practice. It actually tends to clarify things. Okay, what's really important? What's useful? What's beneficial? What's helpful? What can I do to not waste time? I think we chanted it a couple days ago. One of the recollections for one gone forth, that the days and nights are relentlessly passing. How well am I spending my time? So that recollection of death is a very helpful way of clarifying that. Okay, how do I make the best use of my time? At some point, I'd like to hear other monk stories about how they put on the yellow robe. I'm sure they're bursting at the seams waiting to tell. Okay. There is a mean streak in my family. I can see how it has been passed down over generations, grandmother, mother, my sisters, a tendency to be dishonest and manipulative. They also have many positive qualities, but the quote-unquote mean streak runs deep. I've worked hard to overcome these habits in myself. At this stage of life, my familial relationships are mostly positive and harmonious. I do my best to steer clear of these shadows. However, I still sometimes run across their manipulation or dishonesty. It is always very painful to me, especially if it is directed at me. I would like to discuss or address it within my family, but this is difficult because the behavior is unconscious and there isn't interest in becoming conscious. My instinct is to distance myself when I see these unwholesome actions for my own safety and self-protection and to gain clarity and not react. Beyond that, I don't know what to do. They are my family, I love them, and I feel upset when I see these behaviors. There is no apparent recourse or means of addressing the situation. Any suggestions? I think it's hard enough to work it on ourselves. Trying to get your family to do it, it's tough. I think that from what's written, there's a really sincere recognition, acknowledgement of the pain that causes and the unskillfulness of the tendency and effort to free oneself from that. But sometimes with really close relationships like that, family, parents, siblings, sometimes it's too close. Unless the motivation comes from them, or the interest in change comes from them, it's really difficult to make it, put it on the table, just being cautious and clear in one's time with family, so that one doesn't get caught up, because those habits are learned and they can run deep, and they can it's easy to slip back in with conditions around, so I'm abbot of a monastery, teacher of many people, but I don't teach my family anything. that's not why. I mean, they're not interested. My mom is pretty good, but I don't really try. Usually, I try to get her to come to the monastery so she hears Dhamma talks from somebody else. It was like this Katina, it's a month ago? Yeah, it's just a month ago. So I invited my mom down for a Katina, and then Ajahn Viradhamma was at Katina, Ajahn Jayanta was there, so they gave talks at the monastery, so my mom joins in, and she joins in with everything. I try not to sort of teach. But then also, Ajahn Viradhamma gave a talk at Stanford on Monday, and he gave led the meditation and the talk on the first Tuesday in Berkeley. And I didn't buy a return ticket till Wednesday. and I left on Monday. Yeah. I flew to England on Monday. Sweet. Sitting with the Sangha, I'm learning how to feel joy. Delightful. Yeah. Please say more about what a monastic retreat offers compared to an ordinary retreat. What are the differences? I only know what a monastic retreat is. So I don't know. I've heard it's different. we just try to share some of the perspectives and ethos that we see valuable and. I think also just having a, a retreat where some of the traditional forms are chanting, meal offering, or just the aspects of, say, respect. Because it's kind of a part of a monastic ethos. Say, like, so that the Dhamma talk, a formal request is made to... Because, say, as monastics, we shouldn't be teaching without some kind of formal request, some kind of... we can't go and... set up our soapbox somewhere and sort of spread the true word. So then there's a formal request which is done in scriptural language, and it's referencing when the Brahma Sahampati requested the Buddha to teach. There are those with little dust in their eyes. Please teach the Dhamma for their out of compassion. And then, before beginning the talk, take the time to recollect the Buddha and the refuges, and that phrase, Buddhang Dhammang Sangham Namasami. Namasami is namasakar in Sanskrit. So, like, I pay homage, or I offer respects. So that to set a tone of being respectful to the Dhamma and the intention of the Buddha. And it's a really important place to be teaching from, and to set a humility and respect for the Dhamma as first and foremost, as opposed to my intelligent correct opinions about the Dhamma. It shouldn't have any place in it. It should be teaching from a place of respect for the Dhamma. So that's an ethos. Or say when a more junior member is going to speak on the Dhamma, then they'll pay respects to the senior monastic, request to ask permission to speak on the Dhamma. So these protocols of respect are there's a certain ethos that's there. The devotional aspects. Also, just say, like, I think having a retreat where you've got a bank of experienced practitioners sitting up at front and practicing with you, I think it's probably very supportive. As I said, I haven't done retreats anywhere else, but I've heard that's not so common. So, those are some things that come to mind. Okay, if mind and consciousness are impermanent, what/who is aware? Also, who or what is it that experiences the results of karma, especially after the body dies and perhaps is reborn? It's an ongoing process of cause and effect. So it's those causes and conditions that are just in flux, they're changing. It doesn't actually need a who or a what. That's our assumption or our... we posit something in there, but it doesn't really need that. It's like in the different forms of grasping. four types of grasping. Kama upadana is grasping, clinging, attachment. So kama upadana, attachment or clinging to sensuality, attachment clinging to views, attachment clinging to precepts and practice. And then the last form of attachment or clinging is what's attavadupadana. And sometimes it's translated as attachment to self, which is actually an incorrect translation, because what it is it's atta is self and vada is sort of like assumption. And so it's more attachment to the assumption of self. Because that sort of that who or what, that self, is a projection. It didn't really exist. It isn't there. So as we assume it into existence. So that who and what is something that we kind of imagine or assume or make importance with. Okay, can you please explain mindfulness or awareness of consciousness? I can understand consciousness arising as a result of stimuli entering sense doors, but how does one become of consciousness itself? Or is this the right question about consciousness? I think one of the things that is sometimes confusing with the English language is we have assumptions of what they mean. And in the English language, sometimes it doesn't correspond to what it's pointing to in the scriptural language. So that the word for consciousness in Pali is vijnana. And vijnana is always defined as, let's say, the knowing of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and mental events, or the mind consciousness, knowing what's going on in the mind. So but vijnana is jnana is knowledge, and vi is to divide. So that the nature of, say, consciousness is that we, in from a Pali sense or a scriptural sense, it's the discriminating knowledge of the different sense bases, and the mind is just another sense base, but it's what recognizers or knows those different experiences and contact that we have. Firstly, thank you for the generosity of your teachings. They're insightful and valuable. Last night, you spoke about balancing tranquility of mind with investigation or a theme for contemplation. Can you clarify how this can be accomplished without getting into the usual mind states of planning, associating, etc.? This is an important application of the mind in Buddhist practice, is that we learn how to, say, direct attention, evaluate, contemplate our experience. And sometimes those themes for contemplation are, I talked about this morning, the contemplation of impermanence or inconstancy, uncertainty. So that's a theme we bring up for contemplation or reflection. And we can direct thought in a way, but then we also have to pay attention to, okay, what's the result of that? What's happening? Because sometimes when we direct thought, then the mind becomes more clear, becomes more settled. I think Ajahn Kurundama mentioned that as well, of the using the contemplation, reflection, is a helpful way of making the mind peaceful rather than, say, trying to make the mind peaceful first. So that we have to pay attention to the result. And if the mind does sort of incline to planning, associating, proliferating, then we have to stop. Sometimes that's, come back to the body and just, relax, come back to the breath. Sometimes you can pick up a different theme of contemplation. That's where something like contemplation of death. Okay. That usually sort of, it's like throwing cold water on you. And it's whoa, why am I getting all wound up about something so inconsequential? When death is brought to mind, then we say, I don't want to waste time. So that we can use the thinking process. We have to learn how to use the thinking process. There is a kind of axiom that we work on sometimes, or assume, sort of like, I think, therefore I suffer. So then we say, if I didn't think, then I wouldn't suffer. I said, no, it doesn't actually work like that. Because whether you're thinking or not thinking, you can still suffer. you have to learn how to develop both tranquility and stillness of mind. And you have to learn how to direct attention and apply the thinking processes in a skillful way so that it helps the mind be clear and settled as well. So that's learning how to, and these contemplations are a part of that. So that they, that's a, in the Visuddhimagga, that's a path of purification. It's a commentarial text that pulls together many of the meditation practices that the Buddha gave, and in that text, and it points 40 themes of meditation, and a lot of them are discursive meditations using thought, like recollection of the Buddha, recollection of Dhamma, recollection of Sangha, recollection of virtue, recollection of generosity, recollection of the devas, recollection of death. These cemetery contemplations are. One uses an images, but then one brings them to mind, or imagines them. So it's directing attention to the dissolution of the body. One's using the thought processes. And to a certain degree, the meditations on loving kindness and compassion, of sympathetic joy, equanimity, you begin that process using the discursive application of the mind. So that learning how to apply the mind skillfully. Okay, question. Can you say something about the difference between, quote unquote, the mind and the brain? And then say context for the question is attached. Do you think it's worth sharing? I will, although I've studied the Satipatthana Sutta several times, I have assiduously avoided Anapanasati because I have struggled with and more or less abandoned the breath as a meditation object. After this morning's reflection, I now realize that Anapanasati has held the key for me to use the breath all along. Duh. So when we sat, I went immediately into experiencing the mind to breathe in, experience the mind to breathe out, and quickly came to a stumbling block. So probably the mind in say for in Buddhist parlance is the manifestation of thought, feeling, emotion. All of that, and some of it is, of course, much of it's dependent on the brain. But I think it's a lot more nuanced and maybe even complex that we're. We have a lot more going on than, say, just brain stuff. But anyway, whatever the case, the aspects of mind are both the content of the mind as well as the ability to know the mind. Being able to, it's like, and actually the next question is, like, is there a distinction between observing the mind and observing what arises? I think in terms of paying attention to the content, but also paying attention to the quality of knowing. Just that very fundamental ability or aspect of our being, because once you start putting names on it, you think it's really solid. But this capacity within the human condition to know our experience, and that knowing is a doorway into peace and freedom, liberation. There's a, and that's where, so in the Thai forest masters, keep it simple in the sense of understand that quality of knowing, come back to the knowing. And that's the nature of, say, nature of the Buddha, is that the one who knows, the awakened one, the radiant one. And those are the qualities that are inherent within the mind. I mean, there's all the content and proliferations that happen as well, but behind that, or underneath that, is the quality of knowing. And we can keep returning to that, and that's where we can start shedding and dropping and keep returning to that quality of knowing. And that's where our freedom from suffering is possible. Okay. It seems that nimittas are imagery, or the literal translation of nimitta is sign, but it's oftentimes it's a visual image that can appear in meditation. Nimitta can, I mean, it can also be, it could be sound, it could be smell, it could be some other sensory, but it's a sense image that arises. It seems that nimittas can appear before the mind is fully settled in concentration. Is it useful to understand why that is happening? Should one ignore the nimitta until concentration is firmly established? Or is there some other response or skillful way to work with the nimitta while establishing samadhi? It's helpful to not get caught up in, say, nimitta, in the sense of, should one ignore the nimitta until concentration is firmly established? It's helpful to just, to not give it a whole lot of energy, because we love to proliferate, and we love the stories, so that we won't be very long, and we'll be telling a story to ourselves about what this nimitta means or what it's associated with, and it turns into a whole complication. So that it doesn't mean that it's wrong, or but it's sort of like, you want to give yourself the opportunity to let mind, that the continuity of awareness and mindfulness to become firm and settled. Because that's where the clarity of peace will arise. And then if some sort of nimitta arises from that, it may or may not be useful, may or may not be worth following. But at that point, you'll have better discernment and clarity to sort of see. So that it's helpful to just, if nimittas come up, then and to give more importance to that continuity of attention. And different people have different propensities. As I said, I'm blessed with little imagination, so my meditations are pretty straightforward. I don't get a whole lot of images or visual stuff going on. But I know people who do, and some of it can be quite inspiring or motivating. But I think it's important to have the clarity of mindfulness where there's a good feeling of, is this useful or not? Last time I had a nimitta was when I went to England and was just recently arrived, sitting meditation, and then I had the nimitta of bowing to the Buddha, which it's kind of a nice nimitta in sort of its image to come up. But then I realized that I was just nodding.
I've had that one before, too.
Let's have a break.